He visited the wounded at Walter Reed Army Medical Center a number of times. It was always moving to see the spirit and courage of those who had suffered terrible sacrifice, from traumatic head injuries to lost limbs. Most just wanted to return to Iraq to rejoin their band of brothers, though their injuries would prevent it. Modern-day medical care, thankfully, is able to save many more lives than in past wars. One of the most memorable images that stands out to me took place during one of the president's visits to Walter Reed. He would go from room to room, visiting with the wounded soldiers and their loved ones. I entered a room just ahead of him and stood by the doorway. The room was dimly lit. A young mom from Texas and her 7-year-old son were seated next to their husband and father. He sat upright in a wheelchair, motionless. His head was covered in white gauze and bandage from the top down to his eyes. He was clearly not aware of his surroundings. The brain injury was severe. The president entered just after me. He walked over to the mom and hugged her. He put his hand on the son's shoulder and told him, "Your dad is a very brave man." After visiting briefly, Bush turned back to the soldier, placed his hand gently on the wheelchair, bent down, and softly kissed the top of his head before whispering in his ear, "God bless you." Then he turned and walked toward the door. Looking straight ahead, he moved his right hand to wipe away a tear. In that moment, I could see the doubt in his eyes and the vivid realization of the irrevocable consequences of his decision. Many a time, I would see the president walk into a room or area where the family of a fallen soldier was gathered. He would hug the mom or wife. He would visit with them and the dads and children, listening to them share stories of their loved one. Often, a mom would look the president in the eye and say, "You finish the job. You make sure my son did not die in vain." These visits had a way of reinforcing the president's resolve to successfully complete the mission, to press ahead. The momentary doubt became, in the end, another reason for his unshakable determination. Still, another motive for Bush to avoid acknowledging mistakes was his determination to win the political game at virtually any cost. Bush was not about to give the establishment Washington media anything critics could use to damage him and his re-election effort. He knew that in today's political climate, if he admitted error on a consequential matter like the decision to go to war, partisan critics would seize on it and use it to tear him down. On this, he probably wasn't wrong, but I believe that embracing openness and forthrightness could have redeemed him, transcended partisanship, and brought together leaders of both parties to chart a consensus way forward on Iraq. It may not have been on Bush's exact terms or to his preferred way of achieving a successful outcome, but it would have served our country and those we asked to defend it a lot better. Finally, there was Bush's insistence on remaining true to his base. Wary of replicating any of his father's political errors, Bush feared that his conservative base would begin to fracture if he appeared to back away from his commitment to Iraq. Bush and Rove believe that the base wants a leader that is strong, decisive, and firm in his beliefs above all. Since holding the base and keeping it energized was an absolute must in their view, Bush's reluctance to admit error was at least understandable, if not wise. As far as Bush and his advisors, especially Karl Rove, were concerned, being open and forthright in such circumstances was a recipe for trouble. And perhaps they were right for the short term. In the long run, the president's inability to face the reality of his own decisions, as illustrated by that emblematic moment in the press conference, would become a large and steadily growing barrier between him and the American people. It would also help erode any remaining opportunity for bipartisanship and a diminution of the partisan warfare crippling Washington and the American political system. All happening while our men and women in uniform abroad could have used the opposite from Washington. But in May 2004, Bush and Rove were focused on the short term, the fall election. The president had promised himself that he would accomplish what his father had failed to do by winning a second term in office. And that meant operating continually in campaign mode, never explaining, never apologizing, never retreating. Unfortunately, that strategy also had less justifiable repercussions. Never reflecting, never reconsidering, never compromising. Especially not where Iraq was concerned. The first grave mistake of Bush's presidency was rushing toward military confrontation with Iraq. It took his presidency off course and greatly damaged his standing with the public. His second grave mistake was his virtual blindness about his first mistake and his unwillingness to sustain a bipartisan spirit during a time of war and change course when events demanded it. I imagine that my views about Iraq have evolved in parallel to those of many Americans. Before the invasion, I was uncertain about the necessity of waging a new kind of preemptive war. Few people like the idea of going to war. If we are attacked, of course, then we must respond forcefully. But Iraq was different. No attack was imminent. Iraq was not known to be involved in any attack on America, other than firing on our planes in the no-fly zone, and the threat was not urgent. But 9/11 had affected our thinking in a profound way. The shock and anger we all experienced left many of us resolving to avenge the attacks in any way necessary. And our quick military success in toppling the Taliban in Afghanistan solidified broad public support for the president and his administration. Trust in Bush and his tested advisors was extraordinarily high, and so was public deference toward their judgment. I shared that sense of deference. As a Texas loyalist who followed Bush to Washington with great hope and personal affection, and as a proud member of his administration, I was all too ready to give him and his highly experienced foreign policy advisors the benefit of the doubt on Iraq. Unfortunately, subsequent events have showed that our willingness to trust the judgments of Bush and his team was misplaced. Today, my views on Iraq probably still track those of most Americans. Although I've been forced to conclude that we should never have rushed to war in the first place, I want us to succeed. But that success should be defined with a consensus of bipartisan leaders who are focused on doing what is best for the nation. It's clear that our troops have been there too long and been called on, as have their families, to do far more than should have been required. We need to find a way, sooner rather than later, to significantly reduce our troop presence in the heart of Iraq so that our forces can focus on terrorist activity and rapid deployment to assist the Iraqis as necessary. My concern is the same as that of so many other Americans. What is the end game? Where is the light at the end of the tunnel? If more outside support is needed, we need to somehow build a broader coalition, perhaps under the auspices of the United Nations, perhaps with the help of a regional coalition of powers, so that other countries can help bear the burden. Can such a solution still be attained at this late date, with so many people and so much treasure already lost? I hope so. But sadly, it almost certainly will not be achieved by this president. His credibility with Americans and people around the world has been damaged by his refusal to talk honestly about his war and its cost. All he can do now is prepare to pass along the problem to his successor. It didn't have to be this way. Even after the initial mistake of rushing to war in Iraq had been made, the situation was far from irretrievable. But no one in the president's inner circle, myself included, had the wisdom or courage to press him to be more open and honest with the American people. Instead, throughout 2003 and 2004, as the bad news about Iraq slowly emerged, the president and top advisors clung to the belief that the war he had wagered his presidency on would somehow turn out right. As the trickle of bad news turned into a torrent, the president could only double down. In May 2004, the horrific pictures from Abu Ghraib prison surfaced, shaming many Americans and causing a worldwide revulsion that severely damaged our efforts to win the hearts and minds of people in the Muslim world. As the number of U.S. military dead and injured rose beyond expectations, we would reach the 1,000 killed mark shortly before the election, I watched the president grapple with the painful toll up close and in person during those private hospital visits and meetings with the families of the fallen. Just as Vietnam had come to haunt two administrations 40 years earlier, so Iraq haunted both the Bush presidency and George W. Bush, the man. I saw time and again how the sight of a combat veteran gravely injured in battle, or the wife and child of a young soldier who would never come home again, caused Bush deep personal distress, even anguish. But the one reaction Bush would never allow himself was self-doubt. If anything, the painful moments he spent trying to comfort those who had lost loved ones in Iraq, losses caused ultimately by Bush's decision to go to war, only strengthened his determination to prove that the choice to invade had been the right one and that their sacrifice would be for a noble cause. There were moments of hope mixed in with the gloom. The official transfer of sovereignty to an interim Iraqi government on June 28, 2004, helped buoy American spirits. The transfer spoke to Bush's most heartfelt rationale for invading Iraq, to spread democracy in the Middle East, and bolstered the hope that despite its growing toll, the war in Iraq would ultimately seem both just and justified in the eyes of history. As the 2004 election campaign unfolded, and with it the hyper-partisan atmosphere that has become standard for a national election year, other issues took their turn in the spotlight, including the economy, the 9/11 Commission's investigation, a furious controversy over Bush's National Guard service back in the 1970s, and a debate over Bush's plan for providing prescription drug coverage to seniors under Medicare. But three core issues at the heart of the Iraq debate kept dogging Bush and his presidency: whether the rationale for war was deliberately misleading, whether the decision was right or worth it, even without WMD, and whether the administration's handling of the situation on the ground was satisfactory. The permanent campaign battle to manipulate public opinion and shape the narrative to our advantage over each would play a central role in determining the outcome of the election.